Hey, it's Francis Lamb. Thanks so much for downloading this week's podcast. And if you like it, please share it. Leave us a review where you found it. It really helps us out. You can also find recipes and videos and information on just about everything else you hear today on our website, splendidtable.org. But right now, let's get to this week's show. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. The show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. So we've been thinking a lot about recipes lately, like what they are and what they do. Because recipes seem like simple things, right? They're instructions. But they're also promises. And aren't promises always a little bit complicated? You know, they can be kept, they can be broken, they can have consequences no one ever intended. Well, today, we'll hear about a legendary cookbook writer with Alzheimer's, finding her memories through cooking. We'll ask why some recipe writers lie and lie and lie to us about onions. And right now, we'll talk to a cookbook author who wanted to write her book without any recipes at all. Samin Nosrat is that author. She's taught cooking for years. In fact, Michael Pollan credits her for teaching him how to cook. And her teaching revolves around a ridiculously simple idea, that to be a great cook, all you need to know is how to control four things: salt, fat, acid, and heat. Understand those, and you'll always be able to make delicious food, no recipes required. And when I learned about her method, I had that moment, you know, when someone shows you how to see something that's been sitting right in front of you, and you're like, how did I not know that before? Samin, great to have you here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Francis.
So I am so excited to talk to you today because this show, actually, the theme of this show is we wanted to talk about the, you know, the pleasures and pains of recipes. And you have a new cookbook, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, and it's amazing. For listeners at home, I actually, in my double life, I am an editor at a publishing house. And early in my time there, the proposal for this book came in to one of my colleagues, and she right away, like literally 2 hours later, she sent it to the whole team and said, oh my God, this book is amazing. It's going to be incredible. We need to buy this book. And so I was like, oh, let me take a look at this proposal. And reading Samin's proposal actually taught me in so many ways what a great cookbook proposal looks like. And sadly, we didn't win the auction, but the book is out now. And what's amazing is that it's a cookbook that only kind of reluctantly has recipes. So, Samin, why did you want to write the book this way?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I only included recipes at first because I knew there was just no way a publisher would publish the book without them. So, but
we would have made you do that too.
Yeah. But, and I did have a lot of, just philosophical sort of feeling like a hypocrite throughout the making of the book, which was, I was like, well, I'm writing a whole book teaching you how to cook without recipes, only to be followed by the equivalent of a second book of recipes. So the whole idea behind Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat is that if you can learn how to use these four elements, which really play a role in everything that we cook, if you can learn how and why and when to use them, you can make anything taste good with or without a recipe. And as I would teach classes to people, they would end up spending over the course of our curriculum, you know, 20 or 30 hours with me, 4 or 5 hours per element: salt, fat, acid, and heat. And we did a lot of interactive cooking and tasting and adjusting. And I would do everything I could to walk people through the philosophy of how to use the four elements. And we wouldn't have recipes in the classes. And then at the end of the fourth class, every single time, people would come up to me and say, oh, okay, could you just send me the recipe packet, please? And I was like, you guys, come on. I just taught you how to cook without them. And so I came to realize that I couldn't just throw people to the wolves. I needed, you know, as much as I am trying to instill in you this philosophy of instinctual cooking, that you also need training wheels. And a good recipe can be training wheels as long as you also aren't going to abandon your own common sense and your own sense of agency.
It's something beyond, for a lot of people, the idea that it's a training wheel. It's sort of like the coin of the realm, right? It's like, that's actually how we communicate cooking. Like, that's the language we use, is the recipe, even if your whole point in your teaching is saying you don't need a recipe. But what do you think that is? Why do you think people have that mindset?
I think even once you do internalize salt, fat, acid, heat, and I certainly have, I still find myself looking to recipes as for inspiration, or particularly when I'm going into a new cuisine or cooking something from a place that I've never cooked from before. I don't know, you know, the specific spice combinations and amounts of things in an Indonesian curry. So I do need to refer to a recipe for that.
Sure.
And so for me, while it might be a really exotic thing that I need to look at for just even a basic guide or ratios, I understand that this has been my career for, you know, 17 years. So I've memorized a lot, right? Like, and I've created a lot of mnemonics for myself to understand a lot of basics about a lot of the foods of a lot of different cultures. And people cooking at home every day probably don't have that huge internal database. So for them, I think probably that recipe is that sort of security blanket or that training wheel.
So let's go to your food. Salt, fat, acid, heat, right? Like as you said in the book, these are the four things you need to master to really just be a good cook. And after decades of hearing phrases like, you know, pork fat rules and fat is flavor, I think fat is pretty obvious. We know we like fat. And salt is a thing that every chef talks about. Every chef is always saying, you know, the difference between my food and your food at home is I use more salt than you do. So just try using more salt and keep tasting as you salt things along the way. Heat is pretty clear because heat is what actually cooks food. So acid of the four is maybe the one for the average home cook that, you know, we might not be thinking about. And I feel like acid is still kind of like a pro cook's term, right? In regular people language, we just say that acidic things are sour things. So why are these important and why is this one of the four key elements?
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I just started realizing acid kind of sounds clinical, you know, but it is to me and to my palate very, very important. And part of it is because my family is from Iran and Iranian food and Iranian palates are skewed toward sour things and acidic things in ways that other palates are often skewed toward sweet things. And so I grew up eating a lot of tangy things. So I really miss that acidity when it's not there. Mm-hmm. But really, on the most basic level, what acidity brings and what acid balance brings is it helps to balance our food and create contrasts. And I did a lot of science homework. I'm not a scientist, but I did do a lot of homework and found a lot of really kind of cool tidbits. And two of the kind of most interesting things I found out about acid, well, one sort of just about cooking in general, which is as humans, we have developed sort of this instinct that draws us toward contrasts. And in our food, we want contrasts in flavor and in texture and in temperature and in color. And so what acidity offers is sort of a second taste to bounce that first thing off of. So whether it's salty and sour or sweet and sour or even rich and sour, like fatty and sour, if something is balanced properly, then all of a sudden, all of these other parts of flavor become available to us. And so rather than falling flat, all of a sudden we can start tasting all of these different aspects. And I don't know, I was making Caesar salad the other day, and there's all these different forms of acid that I like to work into a Caesar salad, which is already very rich with kind of a mayonnaise-y base and multiple forms of salty and umami-rich ingredients like anchovies and Parmesan cheese and Worcestershire sauce. And so there's already a lot going on. But if you eat it and it's not properly balanced, it will just taste rich and creamy and salty, and there's nothing else. And I find that that happens a lot at Thanksgiving too, where there are so many rich and bland and salty foods on the table and not a lot to contrast with. So in that Caesar, I always am working in lemon juice and vinegar, lemon juice and vinegar, lemon juice and vinegar until I get the balance right and the thing pops in my mouth. And this is sort of where the second really interesting tidbit science thing that I found out comes in, which is so when we use the word mouth-watering, when you think of something as mouth-watering, it's like your mouth is so excited to eat it. You know, it makes your mouth water.
It's like the
you
cliche want more of deliciousness. Of
yeah. But actually, our mouths, our human bodies are like programmed to create saliva whenever we eat something acidic, because acidic things will corrode our teeth. So our bodies actually produce saliva to protect our teeth. And so when you eat something that's properly acidic, it will make your mouth, you know, smack with deliciousness. And so it's that kind of thing where, like, if you're eating that Caesar salad dressing and it's not acidic enough, it's just going to feel cloying and rich in your mouth. And when you're eating your plate of Thanksgiving food and it's just, you know, brown things and creamy things and roasted things, and maybe things that aren't balanced properly with acid, then it's not going to make your mouth feel full and delicious, which is, I believe, my theory about Thanksgiving is, like, everyone's obsessed with the cranberry sauce because on most tables, it's the only acidic thing. So it's this thing where you want that. You want to make sure that every plate and every meal is balanced with acid so that you get that mouthwatering smack.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, it's funny because I have always loved mayonnaise. Like, before I even knew the word for mayonnaise, I remember, like, loving it. And it wasn't until, like, a few years ago. So, like, I'm 40 years old. So I've been eating mayonnaise for, you know, probably a solid 35 years until one day I looked and said, wait, like, the main flavor of mayonnaise is lemon. Mm-hmm. Like, totally. It had never even occurred to me, because I loved it because it was so rich and luscious. You know, it just made every ham sandwich freaking delicious. And then finally realized, like, oh, it actually tastes like lemon. It's not just fat. And you're totally right. A good mayonnaise is perfectly balanced so that you can't really say, oh, is that a sour thing or is that a rich thing? It's just delicious.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And that's what I find is true about pretty much, like, why as humans we're drawn to all the condiments, is because they're sort of, if you don't get your food right, in the first place, you can use the condiments to get you there to deliciousness. And that's the kind of wonderful thing I think about salt, fat, and acid, is that we all already know what something that is balanced with these things tastes like, because those are the things we prefer. And so when you're at the salad bar or the, you know, taco place, and you're putting sour cream and salsa and guacamole, which is made with lime, on your burrito, it's not because, I don't know, you're just like a condiment fiend. It's also because those things take a pile of beans and cheese and meat and make them pop, you know?
Mm. Yeah, like, tasting and balancing with acid, like, such a good thing for cooks to get a feel for. Thanks so much for coming in today, Samin.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. So fun to chat with you.
Samin Nosrat is the author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. And you know, we had such a good time talking about acid that we went long. And she talked about a favorite dish of both of ours, linguine with clams, and how she makes it with this technique of layering in the wine and the lemon and all these different acidic things to end up with just a killer version. You can hear that extended interview at splendidtable.org. And of course, you can find Samin's recipes for Caesar salad and pasta with clams at our website too. And I say of course, because like Samin said of her students, people will always want the recipe, no matter what you teach them. You know, when I worked at food magazines and websites, recipes were the coin of the realm. It never mattered, frankly, how great the stories were, how beautiful the layout or the art. People came for the recipes. That's what got the clicks. And you know, that fact doesn't always sit well with some people. Mostly, you know, serious writers who think that there's more to food writing than just a list of ingredients and some stupid instructions. And a friend of mine, Ronnie Lundy, who, full disclosure, is an author whose book I edited, told me a story literally 2 days ago. And she told me about a friend of ours who became the food editor of a literary magazine. And he said at the time, proudly, that he would never run a recipe in his food section. So Ronnie looked at him and said, well, you know, that's fine, but, you know, that's actually a pretty sexist thing to say. And he goes, well, what do you mean? And she said to him that if you look at the history of recipe writing, in America at least, recipes were mostly written by women who weren't really expected to do any other kind of writing. And if you read between the lines of recipes, you can often find the things unspoken, the clues to their lives, the keys to discovering what they value. You see what's important enough to make for a celebration or what's meant for living on a budget. And you pick up old community cookbooks and you'll see savvy women building up their own reputations while introducing their recipes. Or you see when, in the 50s and 60s, women start emphasizing tricks and shortcuts to save time, meaning to give themselves time to have lives outside of the kitchen. It's all there, just between the lines. So Ronnie gave him a good talk about all this stuff. And you know, after she told me that story, I went home and picked up an old copy of the magazine that our friend was at, and sure enough, there's a recipe for pork chops. Coming up, we talk to Emily Kaiser Thielen, author of Unforgettable, a biography of the legendary food writer Paula Wolfram. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. So, you know the old thing about the Velvet Underground and how their first album only sold 1,000 copies, but, you know, like, every person who heard it went out and started their own band? Well, Paula Wolfram is like the Velvet Underground of cookbook writers. She is most famous for breaking open the world of Mediterranean flavors in America, but the way she did it defined a whole style of food writing. Really intense, immersive research, making no compromises in her recipes, cooking things exactly as she saw them, wherever she was. But there's a cruel irony in her story. A woman who's done so much to document cuisines for posterity is battling dementia and losing her own memory. Emily Kaiser Thielen was Paula's editor at Food & Wine magazine, and 7 years ago, when Paula was updating her first book called Couscous and Other Good Food from Morocco, Emily jumped at the chance to go on Paula's visit back to Morocco. They became close, and after Paula's diagnosis with Alzheimer's, Emily decided she wanted to write the biography of her friend to help save her memories before she lost them. Her book is called Unforgettable. Emily, thank you so much for coming in today.
Hey, Francis. Thank you for having me.
So, Emily, tell me about that trip to Morocco with Paula Wolfram. I mean, you saw her walking in these streets that are so connected to the start of her whole career. And, you know, how did she learn to do that? How did she learn to explore these places? And how did she begin her career as being such an almost anthropologist of these foods?
Actually, I think that was one of my favorite discoveries. Because one of the things that struck me about couscous when I read it when I was a timid line cook in my early 20s was how unbelievably bold and brave she seemed. And there's this amazing back cover image in that book that's now our frontispiece cover in the book, where she's just plowing through this market in this beautiful Moroccan robe and just look like she absolutely owns the world. And so there I was in Morocco, like, desperate to ask her, like, where did you get your bravery? And it actually turned out that her cooking career had started almost as a total act of panic, that her first husband, with whom she'd been married and had two kids, and they had lived very happily in beatnik capitals around the Mediterranean for 10 years, up and left her in 1968 with only a couple thousand dollars. And she had no career. She had been a housewife. She had no faith in herself. And she very heartbrokenly retreated back to New York with her kids and had to do something. And she had sort of dallied in cooking to a quite deep degree, but basically dallied in her first years out of college, and thought, well, that's all I got. I got to give it a shot. And she sort of worked her unusual beatnik connections and found her way to CBS Records, of all places, that was launching this wild service, actually quite similar to Blue Apron or Sunbasket today. Pardon the plug, as I work at Sunbasket, but it was at a much deeper level. This is where they would ship a 6-course dinner party to serve along with an album of music. There was this sort of surging trend in international cooking and throwing dinner parties and having these little gourmet clubs. And they made the mistake of hiring Paula to run these things. And she went off the deep end. She had a French dinner party, which involved poaching your own trout, in skinning the trout, making your own aspic from the poaching water, getting some tweezers, cutting up a pimenton pepper and some lemon zest into little floral petals and making flowers on the trout in the aspic, and then making your own mayonnaise and then pureeing spinach into the mayonnaise. And that was just one of six courses. And she started with French, and then she did Chinese, and then she thought, well, I'm going to do a Moroccan box. And that eventually led to the Moroccan cookbook, because Columbia House Records realized nobody was buying these incredibly complicated dinner party boxes and shut down the program, leaving Paula again totally stranded, right? It's interesting because, of course, we could see it from a mile away, but Paula was totally devastated. And it was, again, in a kind of act of panic that she thought, well, hell, I'll just do a book. And ironically, she was working on a Moroccan party box and a Mexican party box at the same time. And to help her with a Mexican party box, she'd taken a cooking class in New York with a totally unknown aspiring cookbook writer named Diana Kennedy. And they became best friends. And it was Diana who introduced Paula to her editor at Harper & Row, who bought the Couscous book. And when Diana called her editor, Fran McCullough, she said, "Fran, I have a woman here who I think is the real deal." And that's all Fran McCullough needed to hear. And she bought Paula's proposal.
That's incredible. Wow. And, you know, and she turned out to be the real deal. So when you're writing the biography of a living person, it's not just research into their papers and their archives and interviews with friends and families. It's how do you extract the story from a living human being? And in 2013, I believe, right, she was diagnosed with dementia, possibly Alzheimer's. And so there's this horrible irony there of needing to find the memories of a person who's losing them. So when you're doing that, you said that cooking with her was one of the ways you could help bring those memories back. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we actually started the project in 2010 when I moved from New York to California, and we were both intimidated at the idea of an entire biography, so we kind of tricked ourselves and said, we'll just do a series of oral histories. And so I just interviewed her. And I'm very glad we did that, because I was able to get a lot of very clear memories of her early life, where she doesn't have a lot of archival records. But after 2013, we started plunging into her professional life, where she does have an enormous amount of archival records, but her memories are more fuzzy. So there, it was fascinating to not just to the whole process of cooking, like beginning with having her flip through the cookbooks and look back over her own recipes. It was amazing, the specific memories, but the sort of overall feeling she could recall about each book, because she's written 9 books, so, and each one over 5 years. So each book really has a very deep tie to a very specific period in her life. Mm-hmm. And so it was very, like, each book is a little scrapbook on an era of her life, but also because she was so aware and plugged into the American food scene, it was also a real mirror on what was going on in America at the time. So, for example, her Mediterranean Grains and Greens book, which she wrote in the later 90s, was very much a reaction to her moving to San Francisco and discovering all these, this explosion in organic farmers markets. And Paula being Paula, she put it together like, oh, well, if there's all these organic farmers, then they're going to have all these edible weeds. So edible weeds are going to be the next big thing. And she did this deep dive into purslane and nettles and horse mint. And of course, the book is now out of print because she was so far ahead of her time on that. But it was so fun when but as she was flipping through the pages, she said, like, I really went somewhere creative with this. She was impressed by her own work. Mm-hmm. But then when we cooked dishes from it together, I mean, dementia is a really cruel, but also very, this sounds weird to say, but it's a very sort of human illness, because it attacks your brain in the order in which your brain was developed, and it attacks every patient's brain in a different way. So it's very specific to that person, and how it affects them on a day-to-day basis, on an hour-to-hour basis, on a minute-to-minute basis, changes constantly. And so you never know what you're going to get. So I think I say human because it just requires you to be in the moment and very present with that person. So in an interesting, heartbreaking way, we had these very present exchanges over her food. And so, for example, I made this sprinkle pie that is loaded with these blended greens, and she ate it and took a bite and she said, "I don't remember anything." It's like, All right, well, we'll just try again. And she took another bite and she said, "Oh yeah, I learned this with Aglaya." And like little by little, little bits would come out. But just to hear her say, "Oh yeah," just gave me such a charge, because it always was such a crapshoot what was going to come out.
Yeah. But tell me about the physical act of cooking with a person who's, you know, who's struggling with this illness. You write in the book, you know, here are some tips how to retrieve memories with food. And one of the things you write is, oh, sometimes when you're cooking with them, their hands know what to do, even if they say their mind doesn't.
Yeah, I feel like one caveat I should offer, we learned really early on to keep her away from the stoves, because her whole sort of way of processing the cooking process was altered by this illness. So we confined her to prep and watching us cook and sort of offering advice. But in any case, one of my favorite moments of that, we cooked a dish that she had learned in 1958 under Dione Lucas, this kind of precursor to Julia Child, who was her, Paula sort of landed in her cooking class. And it was this dish called sole du gloire, this very classic French fish dish, which is in the book, that really set Paula on fire about food and made her want to drop out of college and apprentice herself to Dione. And so I thought, well, I really want to make this dish and see what memories those evoke. And it's a very Paula dish. There are a lot of complicated steps that aren't counterintuitive, that you think aren't going to work. And I was panicking while I was making it. I was like, "Paula, this isn't right." And she said, "Well, I think it looks right. I haven't made this dish in 50 years, but I think it looks right." And I said, "What, do you have any idea what she means by like roll up the sole fillets?" And Paula just grabbed the fish out of my hand and immediately started rolling them up. And you could tell, and while she was saying that, she's saying, "I have no idea," but just had this physical reaction and had such utter confidence about it. And you knew she had done this 100 times at some point in her life, and that it just came back to her hands before it came back to her mind. It was really something.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today, Emily.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Emily Kaiser Thielen is the author of Unforgettable, The Bold Flavors of Paula Wolfert's Renegade Life. You can find Paula's recipe for that sole du gloire Emily talked about at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can also find another Paula classic, Cassoulet in the Style of Toulouse. This is a hardcore 3-day cassoulet with 6 kinds of pork. Find it at splendidtable.org. So every week, we check in with America's Test Kitchen for their advice on home cooking. But this week, we're taking a little left turn to talk about an ingredient for which there are hardly any recipes at all, and how tricky it is to learn to cook with it. So our managing producer, Sally Swift, talks cannabis with Dan Souza, executive editor of Cook Science.
Hey, Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dan, I want to talk to you about something a little bit different today. I want to talk about cannabis cooking. You know, since so many states have legalized it and people are starting to really work on edibles, chefs are totally digging in with it. I'm wondering what you guys have figured out at Cook Science about what's going on with marijuana and cooking.
Sally, I never thought you'd ask me about weed. So at Cook Science, we are totally fascinated with this kind of burgeoning industry, and we wanted to see what was happening now. We reached out to an awesome journalist, Andy Wright, and she reported this great piece for us about the edible marijuana industry, and it's kind of in its infancy, but it's growing in some interesting ways. And so the big thing that we realized, and that Andy realized in her reporting, is that eating weed has kind of a PR problem. And the reason is...
Because it's not delicious.
Yeah. Well, and taste is probably the smallest factor in that. The bigger thing is that anyone who's tried eating weed at some point in their life has that bad experience. When you eat marijuana, it takes a long time to set in, and a lot of times you end up overdosing, and then it has a really long kind of half-life. So it stays with you for a long time, and you feel the effects. So there are chefs out there. Andy talked to one named Chris Sage out in Northern California, also known as the Herbal Chef, about some of the challenges around that. And he's doing, you know, things that really elevate eating weed way beyond a stoner activity. He's having multi-course gourmet THC-infused dinners in a style that he describes as French with Italian and Middle Eastern influence. So this is much more than just, you know, trying to bake some brownies and get high without the aroma of weed in your basement kind of thing. It's really different. But Chris Sage and a lot of these other chefs are facing big challenges. And so I mentioned some of the issues around kind of the PR stuff around eating marijuana. But a lot of these guys really have to kind of don their science cap and become scientists in order to figure out how to do this stuff.
Because how do you figure out how much THC there is in? You don't know unless you're buying it from a dispensary, correct?
That's right. Yeah. So you don't know how much is in there. So let's say you're buying weed and it's not from a dispensary. You don't know exactly the composition of that weed. So that's one problem. The next level is in raw weed, cannabis, there's actually no THC, which is the psychoactive component that makes you high. There's a precursor to it called THCA. And in order to convert THCA to THC, you need to go through a step called decarboxylation. It sounds pretty technical, but it's really just heating it up to a certain temperature, usually about 240 degrees, in order to convert it over to THC. So when you're decarboxylating your marijuana, you don't know how much THCA you've converted over to THC. So that's another issue. Mm-hmm. Then you don't know how much you extract into whatever fat that you're trying to infuse the THC into, whether it's butter or coconut oil.
And is that the classic? Is that how cooks manipulate pot? They basically get it into some kind of fat?
Well, so THC is very fat soluble. So that is usually the case. They're using, you know, butter is the classic one, but people are testing things with olive oil and, you know, less saturated fats to see kind of the effect that they get. You can also do an alcohol extraction, but chefs are trying some really interesting things, whether they're using a sous vide extraction. So it's, you know, sealed in a container and cooked at a low temperature for a long time to see if that pulls out more THC. They've tried with pressure cookers. There are some that are going full chemist and using a roto-evaporator, which is a kind of a fancy piece of equipment that you can basically separate out certain compounds that you want in a really sophisticated way. So basically anything you see happening in restaurants, you know, fancy restaurants trying to improve flavor or texture, like the chefs are throwing at marijuana to make kind of the best edibles. But so there's all these scientific challenges to it.
So those pot brownies of long ago were actually pretty brilliant devices because it was indeed fat and all that cocoa covers the taste, right?
That's right. What's really interesting is a lot of these chefs now, like brownie is almost kind of a bad word. What they're really trying to do is elevate this cuisine away from that. That was it was a good vehicle for getting high, but we're talking about tasting menus where there's, you know, THC-infused foie gras in one sample, and people are willing to pay hundreds of dollars for it. So there's definitely a desire for this, and it's up to these chefs to navigate a lot of the scientific and legal challenges that are kind of in their way to making this happen.
Well, and this is the other issue is, of course, marijuana is legal in certain states in the District of Columbia, but it's not federally legal.
That's right. And what's really interesting, so at Cook Science, when we do a big story like this, we always like to come back to the test kitchen and develop recipes and run experiments that really tie back to it. So you kind of get that full, you know, something you can make at home that ties you to the story.
Right. And so do you have a brownie recipe for us?
Well, we had really high hopes, no pun intended, of doing this, but we ran into some serious challenges. I mean, one, how do we do tastings? I mean, we taste things constantly in the kitchen, and how do we have repeated tastings over the day? and to figure out how these things taste and how they work. You know, we're also dealing with the fact that it isn't federally legal to do this. So while Massachusetts is a pot-friendly state, you know, our legal team was a little bit concerned whether, you know, that would actually be a good idea for us to do. So our experience really mirrored what a lot of these chefs are dealing with. So there's big demand, and I think we're going to see a lot of things happen in this industry. But, you know, there's a lot of roadblocks in the way still.
It's very interesting. Thanks for filling us in.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Dan Souza is executive editor of Cook Science at America's Test Kitchen. You can find their article on cooking with cannabis at splendidtable.org. Back soon with your calls. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, now I get to talk with you. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252. You can call anytime, leave a message. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can email us, contact@splendidtable.org. So let's get to it. We've been asking for your recipe disaster stories, and Lacey from Westminster, Colorado, was on it. Lacey, thank you so much for calling.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
All right, so what happened?
Well, this is sort of a family legend, but my grandmother, Joan Carter Archibald was her name, she had a cooking show on TV in the early 1950s in El Paso, Texas.
Oh,
so
cool.
She was a really good cook, and she was a really strong lady. And she was also very frugal and sort of matter of fact. So she was one of these people that if you burned the toast, she'd say, just scrape it off. It's just browned. It's not burned. And she made a lemon pie. And somehow didn't put enough sugar in. I'm not sure if there was no sugar or just a little too little, but everybody dug into the pie and it was clearly obvious that it was very sour, very, very tart. And, she said, no, that's how I intended it to be, you know, basically. And, they kept eating and somebody made a joke about the tart pie and everybody laughed. I don't know if you've ever eaten something sour and then laughed, but it hurts really bad in your teeth. And so then that became funny. And so then they're all laughing and they can't stop laughing. And it's an agony because of the sour pie. And so it became known as the laughing lemon pie. And even many, many years later, we still refer to the laughing lemon pie. And I made the pie. I asked my grandmother, you know, what was the recipe for the pie? And she couldn't remember exactly. But she thought it was a lemon sponge from the old Betty Crocker cookbook. So I actually made it, and I don't think I made it as sour as she did. But I backed off way off the sugar to make it as tart as I could stand.
Oh, wait, so you tried to make the messed up pie? Like,
I did, because it was kind of a family legend. That's what I named my food, my blog, Laughing Lemon Pie. So I felt like I had to recreate it and try the recipe. I like sour things, so I thought it was pretty good. But I guess if you were expecting a really sweet lemon pie, it would be a shock.
Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
That's so weird. I totally want to try that. So we have Kathleen from Nashville on the line. Hey, Kathleen, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, I called in with my recipe disaster. This was a few years ago, probably around 2007 or so.
I hope the memory is not too painful. This won't be difficult for you.
Well, I've had some time, so now I can, you know, look at it with a good sense of humor.
Okay,
but
10 years.
Basically, I was with my now husband. We were either dating or engaged, I think. And I wanted to, you know, showcase my domestic qualities. However, I had never really learned how to cook. So I found a recipe online, and I am a rule follower, and I followed every single step exactly as it was instructed. And it was just a basic dish where you do some root vegetables, olive oil, salt, and pepper with, I think I used like tilapia fillets on top, and then you bake it in the oven. And so I followed every single step. I thought, oh, this should be pretty easy. It's nice. It's healthy. And I put it in the oven, and a apparently I had gotten a recipe from like a Canadian website and I did not realize. So it said to put it in at 200 degrees. And so I put it in at 200 degrees exactly. And needless to say, about 30 minutes later, basically nothing had been done and everything was still completely raw.
Oh my God, it was Celsius.
So I was very upset. I was like, I think I was even in tears at one point because I was really trying to impress my now husband.
Oh my God.
And it was really hard. He had to come in and kind of save the day and adjust the temperature so that we could have dinner that night.
So it's like sitting comfortably in the bacteria zone for a half hour is what you made it
do. Absolutely. Yes. And I mean, and I was so devastated because I'm like, I did exactly what the recipe said. And then when we looked back, I was like, oh, that would be Celsius. And I would say that a few years later, I did read Julia Child's My Life in France. Mm-hmm. And once I heard her story about making a French baguette and how she made hundreds upon hundreds of them to get the perfect one and how many times she failed and then just laughed it off and was like, hey, that's a part of cooking. It completely changed my attitude. So
I had
been so sensitive before. So that when I would make mistakes, I would just be devastated and be like, oh, we have to go out to eat and, you know, we can't, there's nothing salvageable. You know, I really tried to take that in stride now. And you know, if you're going to fail, fail big.
Yeah. Well, actually, speaking of Julia and failing, but do you know about her famous omelet flip? The clip is amazing. It's like early on in her show, it's still in the black and white days. And like, you know, here's this woman who's like teaching America the great art of French cooking. And she's demonstrating how to flip an omelet, like the full like flip out of the pan, land back in the pan thing. She does it and misses the pan. And literally half the thing falls onto the stove. And it's like, and this is like how TV worked in the day, right? Like they didn't like a cut. No, half the thing lands on the stove and she just goes, huh, and then scoops it back in the pan like, well, there you go. And it was brilliant.
Well, with that said, one more thing. I forgot about this until you said that, but there was another time when I was actually making ramen noodles on the stove and I had the water boiling. And when I shook the package of ramen noodles into it, some of the noodles were cracked and went outside the pan into the like eye of the stove and caught on fire. So we actually had to use a fire extinguisher and put that out. So that was another story. I definitely blocked that one out.
But actually, you know, it's funny because I also think about like ways to cover for your mistakes. And like, so you can cover for so much just by changing the name of the dish. Like your raw fish could have just been warm tartare and like, boom, bingo.
Sashimi. I like it. Yes.
Or like the charred ramen. Like chefs in 2017 just want to burn everything. It's like, oh, it's charred ramen. Sweet.
Yeah, that's going to be like a new salad topping.
Yeah. Cool. Thanks so much for calling.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
I do have a lot of sympathy for recipe writers. If you're doing the job, you're trying to do your best in explaining in precise detail how to do something, knowing that inevitably, you know, your definition of what medium heat means is going to be different than your readers, or your pans are going to heat up differently than theirs. And frankly, half your readers are going to just do whatever they want to do anyway and blame you if it goes wrong. I remember, I swear to God, reading the comments on a recipe for braised chicken, and the commenter said, well, you know, I don't like chicken, so I use shrimp instead, and then proceeded to cook the shrimp for an hour and a half and complained that the shrimp came out tough and the recipe was terrible. I mean, you really can't win. But there's one thing that weirdly almost all recipe writers do that is bizarre and sort of inexcusable. In his career as a writer, editor, and critic, Tom Skoka has sharpened his sword on lazy media and skewered hypocritical and cowardly politicians. But what he says might be his most important journalistic work came when he took on recipe writers for lying and lying and lying to us about onions. That was in an article he wrote for Slate in 2012, and like all evergreen stories, it keeps coming back. Most recently when Google suggested the same lie about onions and actually attributed it to him. But Tom will not back down, and is here with us today to fight the onion cooking conspiracy. So Tom, what's the problem with onions?
The problem with onions is that it takes a long time to caramelize them. It takes so long to caramelize them that recipe writers through the years, I think, got into the habit of pretending it didn't take that long. A lot of the times when you're reading recipes, it'll tell you that if you put some onions in the pan and take 10 minutes or so, you'll have nice golden brown onions. And it's just not true. And I think that among the people who write the recipes, it's just they think of this as like a little fib that helps you get through the day. The recipe that finally set me off was one in the New York Times for savory scones with caramelized onions. And it said that with 10 minutes of cooking, you'd have some caramelized onions to toss in your scone. And I think I understand the urge to say that in your recipe because it feels like it shouldn't take more time to make the caramelized onions that make your scones have a caramelized onion flavor than it does to make the scones themselves. So, I mean, there are certain falsehoods that everyone understands are falsehoods. You know, the speed limit on the Jersey Turnpike is 65, right? You know?
It's a polite fiction.
Yeah. You know, everybody understands that there's a speed limit, but people drive how they drive. But recipe writers don't understand that people who are reading recipes often don't know how long it takes to caramelize onions.
Okay, so let's talk about caramelized onions. You, as part of your story, your original story in Slate, you saw this, and even 10 minutes, I think you're saying, is you're being generous because you were seeing lots of recipes where like, oh, cook the onions for 5 minutes until golden brown.
Yeah.
Cook the onions for 3 minutes until golden brown. And so you started taking out your stopwatch, and you stood in your kitchen, and you started cooking onions and timing them recipe by recipe. And what is your version of the events here?
So I was trying to do it in the most charitable way possible on, you know, very high heat, but with, you know, your standard apartment kitchen rig. Because the whole point is this is trying to replicate what you might do if you're reading a recipe in the newspaper. And, you know, if I cranked the heat all the way up and I stirred and stirred and stirred and never took my eye off the pan, you know, in about, I think the 29 minutes was when I got something that was caramelized onions.
Yeah. Not five.
No. At 5 minutes, 10 minutes, they're white.
Yeah. Part of it, I think, might be there's sort of a definitional problem here, right? Where, like, if we talk about caramelizing the onions, like, we use that as a very broad term, but the kind of caramelized onions you're talking about, which I believe are the true caramelized onion, is a slow-cooked onion until it turns truly brown, the color of caramel, and it means you've cooked it for a long time, so the sugars and the juices have had time to come out of the onion and actually do the thing that we do when we caramelize sugar, which is, you know, turn brown. And that takes a long time. But I think, like, we just use the word caramelize. I mean, like, any shade of brown anywhere along the line, right? So, like, if people are just talking about, oh, let's just sauté the onions or sweat the onions, and they're just being imprecise in their language, like, that might be the issue, right?
Certainly not in the recipe that set me off. And I think in general, no. I mean, yeah, it's this. The thing is that, yes, there's this particular long, slow process, but that long, slow process produces a particular thing. You know, I mean, if you're making savory scones, you want a sweet, brown, soft onion in there. You don't want a lightly sweated, crunchy onion. Like, that's not the product. And so the thing is that when I first reacted to this, I was reacting as someone who, you know, had put in enough time in the kitchen to know that, you know, if I were cooking something and it told me I was going to take 10 minutes and caramelize some onions, and I spent 10 minutes cooking, I would know that I didn't have caramelized onions in my pan, and I would keep going. I would know what I was trying to end up with.
Right.
But the thing is that after I wrote this, I heard from people, and I still hear from people, you know, who didn't have that background knowledge when they ran into these kinds of recipes. And so you have people coming away believing that they don't know how to cook.
Mm.
They must have screwed something up.
Yeah, I'm a failure.
Right.
I failed, like, not the recipe.
And people really believe this. And, like, that's pretty messed up, especially for, you know, newspaper recipes, which are supposed to be reaching out to people who are maybe going to try something they never tried before.
Yeah, yeah, that's the damage. Are there other culinary untruths that you want to take on at this point?
That's pretty much the one that haunts me. I mean, besides the fact that everybody fetishizes San Marzano tomatoes and you keep finding San Marzano tomatoes that have, like, spice powder in them, yeah. You should never, ever use something that has spice powder in it. You know, you're better off with just a regular old Hunt's tomato than with something that has factory oregano in it. So there's that. But besides that, that's about all I got.
All right, man. We will fight that battle another time. But thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, glad to do it.
Tom Skoka is the deputy executive editor at Gizmodo Media's Special Projects Desk. And you can find a recipe for caramelized onion dip with feta, spinach, and walnuts by our dear friend Kat Kinsman, with a proper cooking time for onions. And that's at splendidtable.org. That's the show for the week. Thanks so much for joining us. Let me leave you with these lines from Emily Dickinson, which she happened to write on the back of a coconut cake recipe. The things that can never come back are several. Childhood, some forms of hope, the dead. Though joys, like men, may sometimes make a journey and still abide. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thanks to everyone who's contributed and made this show possible. We literally couldn't do it without you. And to help support our show, just head to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, look around. There are tons of recipes, info on all of our guests, a whole bunch of videos, and you can sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it'll make your Monday to Friday cooking a little easier. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell and assistant producer Erica Romero. Jenny J. Lou Lupke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for listening. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.